Matrix is a system, Neo. That system is our enemy. But when you're inside, you look around, what do you see? Businessmen, teachers, lawyers, carpenters, the very minds of the people we are trying to save. But until we do, these people are still a part of that system, and that system, and that makes them our enemy. You have to understand, most of these people are not ready to be unplugged. And many of them are so inert, so hopelessly dependent on the system, that they will fight to protect it.
What's up, y'all? Stop this damn music, man. My damn phone. What's up, David? Y'all can hear me? How y'all doing this Sunday morning? How's everybody doing? Hope y'all having a blessed morning as I am. It's another day on God's, you know, green, beautiful earth, another day to make a difference. You know, another day to be great, another day to liberate. I want to talk about this morning. Actually, I have a couple of things going on this morning. This is going to be a busy, you know, a busy intellectual week for me. Just let me give some context to the Great Liberators Radio Show. What we are and what our niche is dealing with nuance. That's what my vision for the show always was. That's why I called it the Great Liberators, sophisticated Black intellectualism. Operating in the nuances of issues, because many times on these issues, the truth is somewhere in the middle, and it doesn't lie in the black and white, but it's many times in the gray. And so that's what I wanted to bring, a fresh perspective, a different take, using logic, reason, critical thinking, and objectivity to traverse the issues that tend to divide us. We are not necessarily ideologues. We don't necessarily subscribe to a particular type of ideology. But what we do is look at issues from both sides, understanding that these things have various intersecting points. Looking at the omnidirectionality of various issues. And so that is our niche. That is our goal. To give instruction, to give commentary, to give a certain level of insight and understanding to things. And this is something that we wanted to be focused with, you know, with our people. And that's what we're getting back to. This is why I took the break from YouTube, because dealing with the ignorance in a particular sector of Black YouTube that I was dealing with, it's easy to get bogged down with that negative energy, and you'll lose sight. All right, can y'all hear me? No matter how unpopular the message, there's always an audience. And so that's what we're, you know, that's the direction we're going in. So I'm going to have a busy, you know, a busy week, a busy intellectual week dealing with different things. This evening, I'm going to be on my blog talk show, the Great Liberators Radio Show. We're going to be dealing with this Black Hebrew Israelite farce and much of the misogyny. And, you know, much of the misogyny that is prevalent when it comes to that particular community, and how these things have, you know, turned into real tangible. Nobody stepped on the court. I don't know why it does that every now and then. StreamYard. I'm just now getting used to it. God, man. But yeah, I'm going to be dealing with the Hebrew Israelite community. A lot of the bullshit that goes on with these dudes, how they look to exploit women, take advantage of women. And you know, just expose a lot of the crap that goes on with those guys. So I'm going to be doing that this evening. That's going to be on Blog Talk. The number for that show is 516-418-5457. This Tuesday at noon, I'm going to be actually debating J.B. Gunner. This is the individual who had his scrape with RBR, and apparently it wasn't a good showing for RBR. He's going to be on my platform, and we're going to be debating entitlements, because we know that the very basis for the word entitlement is a stigma to suggest or imply that there's a group of people getting something that they haven't earned or that they haven't deserved. And when we talk about entitlements, nothing could be further from the truth. What you have with many of these neoconservatives, you have liberals calling liberals a liberal. That's what you have. And within a larger context of that, briefly, we have to understand that the government as we understand it, America as we understand it, was founded upon liberal principles. It was founded upon liberal principles, Lockean philosophy and theories about government. So that served as much of the basis for the Declaration of Independence, the United States Constitution, etc. So I'm going to be dealing with that Tuesday. Today, what I have on the ledger, I want to break down briefly the dilemmas of Black manhood and womanhood. Hey, Miss Blue Love, focused this morning specifically on Black women and the ways in which white society has weaponized and vilified her emotionally. And what we have to understand as Black men and Black women is that these things are relevant and present for both of us. There are dilemmas that arise from being Black and from being male for Black men. And conversely, there are dilemmas that arise from being Black and female for Black women. This is the absolute truth. Much of the vitriol and the venom that exists between Black men and Black women, at least in social media, these arise from internalization of whiteness, of our concepts and our constructs about what manhood is and what womanhood is. But these are constructs that exist in the mainstream of white thought, of whiteness as we understand it. Whiteness as a social construct. That's why I put a video up talking about it briefly, understanding whiteness as a social construct and what that means. Something else I'm going to be getting to is this idea of the social contract. not today, but just I'm just, you know, talking about this while it's on my mind. I'm going to be talking about the social contract because David and I had a little exchange on one of my videos. And see, this is the privilege that arises from being a white male, because when you talk about the social contract, what you are essentially talking about is institutionalized rape. That's what you're talking about. That's a nice way of saying institutionalized rape, where we control all of the apparatuses of the society in order to garner sexual acquiescence out of the subjugated group. And it's particularly curious that you have brothers who buy into this type of thinking when they would do the same thing to black men. This is how white women were able to rape black men, because of the social contract, because it was their men who had unilateral control over the systems and the apparatuses of the American society. See, and so the institutionalized belief of white male superiority, white male dominance, that white men are the inherent social dominant group, are problematic, when the fact is that white men have not built anything within a vacuum. The first blood shed on this country's foundation was the blood of a black man. So how is this intrinsic inherent dominance of white men evident? So I'm going to be dealing with that. When you say social contract, what you really mean is institutionalized rape. Now, aside from that, I want to deal with the topic at hand this morning. Anyone who's been privy to Black YouTube, the particular sector I was dealing with, what you would have found is ignorance, anger, abstinence, and just an overall lack of empathy one for another. And if anybody who understands me, understands how I came on YouTube, understands how I started podcasting, you know that that is not my natural disposition. That's not my natural disposition. That's not what I'm about naturally. So what I want to do, I want to talk about how the culture that exists within American society has placed this stigma and stipulation on black women. And unfortunately, we've internalized it. Not just black men, but also black women, because the truth is you do have many sisters who engage in behaviors and a disposition that give the stereotype relevance. If you've listened to me at any length of time, you've heard me talk about the brute caricature, which is how they have always portrayed black men, and the Jezebel caricature, which is how they portrayed the black woman. That Jezebel caricature is rooted in her hypersexuality. See, and as brothers, we want to buy into that. But see, what we don't understand is that what they put on the black woman is a reflection of you. That's why they're putting it on her. See, in many of the ways that we view black women, these other outer ethnic and racial groups view you in the same light. This is why I told brothers, tell me one group of patriarchal men that's happy to see their daughter dating you. The same stereotypes and stigmas that you put on sisters, they put on you. So they're going to say your STD field. They're going to say all you create is bastard children. They're going to say all you're hypersexual. See, the very way they have portrayed our bodies as black men and black women has been in the service of white domination in an effort to dehumanize and over-sexualize not just black women, but also black men. This is where the idea of the well-endowed black male comes from. That's a racial stereotype. And we're so colonized, so deluded morally and ethically, that as black men, we love that stereotype. We love the stereotype of being this sexually viral male, because we've internalized the idea of what white manhood is. We've internalized that. See, we have internalized that. That is a racist myth. The earliest iterations of anti-Africanness, not blackness, but Africanness, because at this time, blackness was not a social construct. Oh, whiteness wasn't a social construct. But anti-Africanness is found in the Babylonian Talmud, where they say that because Ham, the curse of Ham, was Africans being cursed with dark skin and elongated penises. But here today, as de facto Sambos, we buy into that stereotype, when that stereotype has been the very basis for the subjugation, murder, and dehumanization of black men. Likewise, they did the same thing with sisters. The way they portrayed their derrieres, the way they portrayed their hips, the way they portrayed their bodies. So we have to understand that. We have to understand that. The name that this, the term, should I say, that this stereotype is known as is the sapphire caricature. The sapphire caricature, which portrays black women as hand on her hip, big, belligerent, loud, overbearing, and emasculating. And unfortunately, you have sisters who hop on YouTube every day and do black womanhood a disservice by reinforcing that stereotype. As I've gone back and listened to many of the panels I've been on, I've become ashamed of myself, ashamed of the way I acted, ashamed of the way I communicated, ashamed of the entire discourse. Because what it displayed is it didn't display us in a positive light. Not just me, but all of us. Screaming, hollering, yelling, insults. But yet we all want to claim to be intellectuals, but can't even articulate a point without being civil, without being patient, without being insulting or condescending. So it wasn't a good look. If we want to be honest, many times brothers have done ourselves a disservice by the way we act, by how we portray these images about ourselves, the idea of the super predator. Same thing is true for sisters. And the first part of alleviating a problem is education. So my goal this morning, very briefly, is to educate you all or all those who will listen . Supreme King Coon, best way to beat a stereotype is not to portray any of said stereotype's qualities. However, if black women act along with the stereotype, then it isn't a stereotype, it's truth. I agree with that. What's up, Dallas Cowboys? I agree with that to an extent, because we know that all stereotypes have some truth, have a grain of truth. But I think the larger issue here is you put the stereotype out to see the behavior psychologically. To psychologically see the behavior. This is why I talked about the strong woman, the strong black woman. We have to understand that it was the system of white supremacy that defeminized the black woman, that masculinized the black woman, that intimated to the black woman her strength is rooted in her ability to be dominant, domineering, and obstinate with her black man. So you put the stereotype out into the culture to seed the behavior. See? So it's a binary thing. White supremacy cannot exist and function without black inferiorization. So I do agree with your assessment to an extent. But what I don't want to do is make this a blame black woman thing. That's not what I've been trying to do. What I want to do is show how we all have been subverted by the American cultural ideas and cues about manhood and womanhood that is rooted in whiteness. And when we do that, we automatically disqualify ourselves from certain things because there's nothing we can do about being black. It's a forced identitarian classification. And so that's what I'm going to be aiming to do this morning. So maybe next time when you're on a panel with a sister, if she hears this video, she'll be more reticent to engage in that type of behavior. See? So that's the goal. I don't want to point fingers. I don't want to denigrate black women. I don't want to denigrate black men. The goal should be educating one another, educating ourselves, being autodidactic when it comes to cultivating a better crop of black men and black women, if that's what we say we want. And I thought that's what everybody said they wanted. So with that, I actually have two guests coming on. And also at 11:45, damn, it's 11:30. I'm going to have to push it back. But I'm going to be debating this African brother real. It's not going to be long, but I'm going to be debating him because he caught wind of my ADOS video and he has a problem with it. You know, so I'm going to do that briefly too, and then I'm going to get off of here. But No, David, these are stereotypes. You know what I'm saying? These are stereotypes. When we talk about the mammy caricature, the sapphire caricature, these are stereotypes. So let me do this. I got an email. Let me see. How do I? Okay, hold on, y'all. I gotta send two emails. Okay. Invite. Okay. Gmail. I just gotta send two emails. Because I actually have two new co-hosts who are going to be joining me on my podcast, and she's gonna join me on this real briefly and just talk about how she's her experiences with this. So once I send these emails out, I'm gonna read some literature about what I'm talking about. It's not like I'm just making this up. Okay, let me send that. That didn't work. Oh, okay, I see what I did. All right, Von Shea, I sent that first email. Now, y'all know my brother Chaos is always with me. Oh, hold on. So I'm emailing him, and then we'll get into it. It's not gonna be long. So I'm not gonna read all of the literature. Just gonna get some bullet points out of it, and I'm probably gonna, you know, single some people out, not in a disparaging way, but just to show how we do ourselves more harm than good many times. Okay. Exactly, Dre. He's exactly right. He says tearing down white supremacy correlates with tearing down the black woman's perceived notion of strength. Are black men ready to withstand that fire? Exactly. And this is why I've been trying to bring a certain level of understanding to these things. And we could disagree, but this is just what it is. I have no interest in being at war with black women. I think it's easy to do that. David Monroe said, in slavery, you act how master tells you to. But what about after slavery? Well, David, these things become culturized, brother. Like we got to realize that it becomes culturized. And so, this has become a certain culture. And it's unfortunate, but that's what it is. Now, do we want to complain about it or do we want to solve it? That's my thing. If you listen to me, I don't try and discredit people's experiences. I don't try and invalidate what they're saying. I try to understand where they're coming from. I think that is the hallmark of being an intellectual. Are we intellectuals or are we ideologues? See, that's my thing. And this is why I don't subscribe to Red Pill and all these different things, because that would mean I'm an ideologue and I'm not. I pride myself on being an intellectual, and part of doing that is being objective and not personalizing issues. And that's what I've tried to do. All right, hold on. I'm still sending this. Okay. All right. So let me put the screen share on. Screen share. Share. And if anybody wants to educate themselves on the various stereotypes and caricatures that have been portrayed about black men and black women, this is an excellent site right here. The Jim Crow Museum of Racist Memorabilia. And what we have here is, can y'all see that? What we have here is the Sapphire caricature. That's the Sapphire caricature. I got 28 people watching. Get the likes up for me, y'all. Get the likes up. All right. So this is the Sapphire caricature. And I'm going to be reading from, I'm going to be reading from it. And look, David, look, this is what I want you to do. Hey, David. When I read this first part, I want you to type the name of the individual that comes to mind when I read this. All right. Is that a deal? Supreme King Coon, you could do it too. When I read this, I want y'all to type the name of the individual that this sounds like. All right. All right. So here we go. It says the Sapphire caricature portrays black women as rude, loud, malicious, stubborn, and overbearing. This is the angry black woman popularized in the cinema and on television. She is tart-tongued and emasculating, one hand on a hip, the other pointing and jabbing, violently and rhythmically rocking her head, mocking African-American men for offenses ranging from being unemployed to sexually pursuing white women. She is a shrill nagger with irrational states of anger and indignation and is often mean-spirited and abusive. Although African-American men are her primary targets, she has venom for anyone who insults or disrespects her. The Sapphire's desire to dominate and her hypersensitivity to injustices make her a perpetual complainer, but she does not criticize to improve things. Rather, she criticizes because she is unendingly bitter and wishes that unhappiness on others. Now, who that sound like to y'all? David said, Cynthia G and most of my exes. But this sounds like Cynthia. And I'm not taking a shot at Cynthia. I'm not taking a shot. I actually regret ever saying anything disparaging about Cynthia. You know, I value my friendship, so I regret saying anything disparaging about her. But this sounds like Cynthia. Like, this is how many times Cynthia would come across. And even though it's not, it may not have been what she was trying to do, this is what it sounds like. And see, you can't, when you're dealing with brothers, you can't be tone deaf in the way that you're levying your criticisms. The criticisms could be valid, but the moment you begin to communicate like that, then it's going to cause the brothers to get defensive too, and vice versa when brothers deal with sisters. Like, if you go back and listen to my first time I was on O'Shea's Sunday Royal panel, I tried to be conciliatory to sisters. And I even told them, go back and listen how you guys are talking and communicating with these brothers. See, it's become culturally normal for sisters to have this disrespectful disposition when it comes to black men. And how do you think you're going to get anything done like that? How do you think that's going to work? See, and then wanting to use black men's position in the racial order as a means to disparage not only his manhood, but his very humanity. And then we wonder why we can't have long lasting relationships that are fruitful and that are whole. See, this is the way we communicate with one another. And I talked about this on Facebook. When we talk about communication, when we talk about language, these things are inherently feminine. Because the first communication a child gets is from his mother while he's in the womb. This is how we were able to develop language and speech patterns. Our first communicator, our first conduit of information is our mothers. See, and sisters, while talking and conversing with brothers, can have very legitimate gripes, and it comes across as emasculating. Asking questions like, "What have black men done for respect?" As if we aren't human beings. And so when you take on that disposition, what you're suggesting is that there is a litmus for personhood. There is a litmus for humanity. As if that humanity is not evident. That's deeply cynical. See? Not understanding the nuances of what you're saying. The nuance is that black men aren't human beings. So you're dehumanizing black men when you ask, what have we done for respect? Suggesting that we have to do something to get respect as a human being. While saying you're against white supremacy, while also iterating white supremacist sentiments. And then wonder why we can't get anywhere. I'm going to go on. The Sapphire caricature is a harsh portrayal of African-American women, but it is more than that. It is a social control mechanism that is employed to punish black women who violate the societal norms that encourage them to be passive, servile, non-threatening, and unseen. We can have a discussion about that. I think that goes both ways. I think in many ways, there are things that black women benefit from within the social order because they're black women. I think that's undeniable. You know, competing interests exist over competing privileges. See, privilege is not just one thing. Privilege is not a monopoly. It's not a monopoly in a social order in a societal context, privilege is omnipresent. So competing interests exist over competing privileges. And so these things can intersect in many various ways and directions, the omnidirectionality of many of the issues we talk about. And so if we don't understand that larger context, we do ourselves a disservice when we talk about them from a one-dimensional aspect. So I'm going to go on. I sent y'all the link, Chaos and Von Shea. It says, Sapphire Stevens, from the 1800s through the mid-1900s, Black women were often portrayed in popular culture as sassy mammies who ran their own homes with iron fists, including berating Black husbands and children. You know what? While I think about it, if any of you guys who are listening, hit the like button for me. And if y'all have a Facebook page, a Twitter page, whatever it is, Chaos, why are you calling me, brother? I'm on the air. Hold on. I don't know why Chaos does that, man. He'll see me on the air and then he'll be calling. I'm like, yeah, I can't answer the phone. Oh, he on. Okay. My fault. I stand corrected.
Yeah. Okay. I'm not sure if you check if the StreamYard is very active when people know somebody's in the back room. It should tell you.
What you mean? What you mean?
Like anytime if somebody, like you send a link and somebody's in the back room, it's usually.
Oh, yeah, yeah, okay, yeah, yeah. I see. My fault.
Hey, you know what's funny? I was asking what time you start because I want to be just right there when you start because I'm not sure if we're getting notifications. I'm just checking my phone now and said.
I know I got a notification. Like when I scheduled it, it didn't give me a notification, but when I went live, it did.
Man. I don't know. But continue, please. Continue.
All right. Yeah, so if y'all have a Facebook, whatever social media y'all have, please share the link for me. But let me go on and see what I want to do is I want to show how these things are binary. See, they don't that like when they put a negative stigma or stereotype on one of us, they're not excluding the other. There's going to be a counter to that reflects on the other party negatively. That's the entire point. So even like if we talk about the whore culture right now that unfortunately many sisters have bought into. She says she hadn't received it yet. Oh, okay, Von Shea, hold on one second. Shoot. Invite. She says she hadn't received it. All right, let me see. Maybe I sent it. Hold on, y'all. One second. Go ahead. What's your thoughts on it right quick, guys? I gotta send this email link.
Be honest with you. I just tune in. The only thing I could say, in regards to the definition of Jezebel, if it that's what the definition is written, it probably makes a lot more sense. But like I said, I don't advocate this thing we call interracial squirrel or interspecies breeding, how the system wants a good portion of the Black population here in the West and anywhere outside this country to start engaging interspecies mixing because when one species is dying off, you got to have something to replace it. And like nature, nothing really dies off quietly. They're going to go down with a fight. That's what I want you to understand.
Right. All right, Von Shea, I sent it again to the email you gave me. Let me know if you get it. What if I told you, Chaos, that I have a source. You're showing that? Yeah. I have a source that from the early, I can't remember when the time period was written, but it says that the estimates were 70 to 80% of Negroes were already mulatto.
And what? How far ago was that?
I'd have to look at the book.
Because
I don't have it with me right now. Go ahead.
To go into that, we got to look at, say, when we, like I say again, interracial breeding. You know, the Negro, either the DNA wise or stuff, you got to look at, you know, what has happened to what we call the melanin man, the dark skin man, the black skin man and woman in centuries, you know, because we all know Egypt fell, whatever reason it fell. And what you see most of the people that were trying to keep their genetics you know, sacred.
Yeah.
Like any other tribe or any nation at a time, when something is now at a crumble, what they do, Omari, they leave and they go somewhere else to build another nation and community, right?
Right.
The ones that stayed or were caught up on it, what they did, they interbreed, intermingled with a new nation that was going to be the ruling class. Greek and Roman history, you know? These would happen. So there are some people out here that still doesn't have what we call the mulatto mixing, or what we call the Eurocentric or non-black gene in them.
Right.
Look at the Adam. We'll look at the, what's it called, that place in India that people were talking about, that that Christian dude got killed.
Mm-hmm.
That tribe still has the original genome that was left in ancient time. Same thing, some tribes in Africa.
Right.
Africa is a continent itself, very big continent. Now everybody got intimate with the Arab, which is a mixed breed in itself, and the Caucasoid and the Asian. Right. You know?
Right. So, well, hold on. I don't want to get too off the beaten path. We'll come back to that at another time. I want to finish getting through this. Because my time running short. It's 11:50. It said from the 1800s through the mid 1900s, black women were often portrayed in popular culture as sassy mammies who ran their own homes with iron fists, including berating black husbands and children. These women were allowed, at least symbolically, to defy some racial norms during the Jim Crow period. I just mentioned that when I was talking about that part up top. It says, when real blacks were often beaten, jailed, or killed for arguing with whites, fictional mammies were allowed to pretend to chastise whites, including men. Their sassiness was supposed to indicate that they were accepted as members of the white family, and acceptance of that sassiness implies that slavery and segregation were not overly oppressive. See that?
Yeah. Good.
It says, segregation was not overly oppressive. A well-known example of a sassy mammy was Hattie McDaniel, a black actress who played feisty, quick-tempered mammies in many movies, including Judge Priest, Music is Magic, The Little Colonel, Alice Adams, Saratoga, The Mad Miss Manton, and Gone with the Wind. In these roles, she was sassy, but always loyal. She was not a threat to the existing social order. See that?
Yeah.
And I told, that's what I'd be trying to tell these sisters. You sitting here trying to live up to this damn myth of being strong and independent. This is the mammy caricature. And what you've done, hold on, okay, let me finish the point. And what you've done, you've inverted the meaning of mammy. See, because the mammy's existence was twofold. It was to make sure white supremacy's execution from the dominant class to the subjugated class was absolute. And so in order to do that, she would have to have an emasculating effect on her male counterpart. And precisely because brothers have mothers, she is the first conduit of the social stigma of making a black man stay in his place, knowing his place. The mammy was the protector of the white man, not the black man. And what you have is many of these sisters hop their tails on YouTube, Facebook, and use mammy incorrectly. So if a sister want to be down with a brother, you call her mammy. And then wonder why your homes and your community is desolate. Wonder where the men are.
Well, you know, it goes back to people that are very stupid and don't know fucking words of definition of the word mammy. I did a stream on this months ago when I heard regular women, especially women that call themselves sisters, use that term incorrectly. Mm-hmm. And you know, you can't educate dumb fucking niggas. You know what I'm saying? Especially some women on here. That's it. Still calm. But it's like this. Is it ironic you call black females or black women, mammy, and you're engaged in mammy behavior.
Exactly.
Men.
Exactly.
So this can't be used as a proper shame attack, because down the line, this is my thing, Mary.
Mm-hmm.
the American school system, public, charter, and all that stuff, they don't educate people. I'm going to say this again. The public, the charter, and private schools, depending on where you go at or where black people go to or other non-black people go to, they do not educate people.
Right.
The reason why I say this, because to be actually in a quest of education is a continual struggle. You have to understand not only the written word, but the language. And the more you get a grasp of it and keep honestly looking at these definitions of these words as people present us, you have a clear view of the coded language your so-called press to use on you, that we use on our own tongues.
Right. Vance, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Hey, how you doing this morning? This is my new co-host, co-host, y'all. This is Miss Vance. She's gonna be co-hosting me, her and her cousin, sister cousins. What you say, Vance? All right. So you've been listening in. I know as a black woman, how does this stereotype affect the way you're perceived and your interactions in a larger American society?
Well, I get the angry black woman label placed on me. And you know what? Sometimes I am angry, and I will tell you why. Okay. I used to be angry all the time until I learned how to channel my anger into different avenues. But what I used to be angry about was, we always talk about, well, when I meet people and then they learn about me, and that's the first thing that they say is, oh, you're so strong. And it's like, well, I was forced to be like this.
Right.
I was grown to be strong because starting from 8 years old, I never had a support system. I was abandoned by both of my parents, and I grew up in foster care, and I'm the oldest of six kids. And I was always placed in adult situations, even as a child. But there was nothing that I could do about it because, you know, unfortunately, the adults in my life failed me. So that's where the being strong mindset, it started from being 8 years old, never having anybody to depend on or rely on or lean on or ask for help. I was always forced to figure everything out and solve not only my problems, but everybody else's problems. And I also not only had to think for myself, but think for everyone else.
Right.
And that brings me to where I'm at now. I'm 37. Mm-hmm. And I still don't really have a support system. I have developed relationships over the years that are emotionally supportive, but it's still basically the same thing. I have to take care of everyone. I have to do everything. And that's just how it's always been. And I also have to remind people sometimes when I meet men sometimes, and, you know, with me owning my own business and just having a lot of things that I have established for myself. After my marriage, I was married for 10 and a half years. And I meet people and they say, what if you meet a man? Are you going to allow him to be a man? And it's like, well, I can't allow you to be something that you should already be being. You know, and if I met someone that wanted to come in and help me and be there for me, I would accept it. But people don't realize that that has never been offered to me, even when I was married. Help and support and financial support, things of that nature have never been offered to me, not only from my ex-husband, but never from my children's fathers or anyone else. If it was offered, I would accept it, but it's never been offered to me. And I meet a large amount of Black women where this is happening as well. Support, financial support, emotional support, physical assistance. Those things are not being offered, but if they were being offered, we would accept them.
Right. I get that. And see, this is Dr. Wilson talked about this in her book, The ISIS Papers. And many times what we call the Black matriarchy is actually an imbalance because war is levied against the men. And unfortunately, in many of these communities, these closed communities, our communities, the men are rendered ineffective for the most part. Donald Trump came out touting the lowest rates of African-American unemployment or whatever. That's a farce. That's a shell game. When we talk about unemployment, unemployment and joblessness are two different things. The unemployment numbers that they give you on the news, these are not the real unemployment numbers. They cook the books to give this false perception of this wide, you know, widespread employability for Americans. You see what I'm saying? So, you know, we engage in these tropes within this gender war that I've graciously bowed out of because it's a Sisyphean effort and it's unfruitful. But, you know, what we do, we use these tropes to disparage one another. If we talk about women and their choices in men, the fact is that procreation is a lot like crime. It's all about proximity. When you look at the way the spatiality of the country is laid out and how segregated our communities are, there was a study that was done by the New York Times, and they found that in urban Black areas, the women outnumber the men by a wide margin. I've talked about this. W.E.B. Du Bois in his study of the Negro family, he cited the gender asymmetry where the women outnumber the men in the urban environment. This creates an imbalance, and it ramps up the sexuality of that area. See, so we never want to give account for that. But then in that same study for the New York Times, when they went and looked in the white area, the men outnumbered the women. So it's going to be more balance. See, this is the way they are able to influence certain things and cause certain things through their segregationist policies. See, segregation just isn't because white people don't want to be around you. It's a form of social, political, and economic quarantine to create certain realities in our environments, understanding that the environment is going to cause a behavior, and the behavior is going to become a habit, and then that habit is going to become a culture. See, so this is how they do it. So, you know, I get everything that you're coming from, and this is something I hear from sisters about, you know, the reality of what it's like being a Black woman in American society, having to do for self, having to be self-sufficient. I have no problem with a sister being self-sufficient. The problem that I have is when you take on this moniker of being independent. See, being independent is different than being self-sufficient. There's nothing wrong with a woman being self-sufficient. The fact of the matter is that self-sufficiency is a requisite of adulthood, whether you have a man or not, whether you have a husband or not. Because even when a man and a woman are married, both of them have to be self-sufficient and have to be able to operate independently of each other for the greater good or the collective or the whole of the family unit. That's the way that's supposed to be. And what you have is you have many sisters who are self-sufficient, and you have many brothers who are codependent, who are looking for a mama wife. These brothers who want mama wives. And then those same brothers would be sitting up on YouTube somewhere trying to cite Fantasia of why, even though as the woman you doing everything, you should be submitting to him. See, we're going to talk about that tonight with a lot of these damn Hebrew Israelite clowns who mm-hmm. type of behavior. You know, a sister called me the other day and she was telling me, you know, she was with this guy trying to give this brother a chance. He with this, you know, the Hebrew Israelite thing. And he living with his mama and grandmama, a grown ass man. But yet he wanted to try and tell her what to do and want to try and take her check. You know what I'm saying? Because I'm the man. I'm the man. But haven't demonstrated one quantitative, qualitative leadership skill. So what it is, you think just because you have a ding-a-ling, you're supposed to be in a preeminent position. You're supposed to be in the dominant position. That's not the way social hierarchies work. Social hierarchies are supposed to be based on competence. When you look at the agricultural revolution, how we get to where we are today, how we move from hunter-gatherer societies to the societies that we have now, which give us the first inferences of patriarchy, which is the first hierarchical social systems in our modern time. That was based off of competence, because it was the advancements in agriculture that allowed resource hoarding, that ingratiated several women to one man, that necessitated paternity certainty of those men so they could pass what they acquired onto their heirs, that give us the dynamic we have now. So companies, hierarchies have nothing to do with gender. So it's not just because I'm the man. Well, I'm the man. No. Hierarchies are based on competence. And unfortunately, what my sister Von Shea laid out and just demarcated it, is the reality for many sisters, where many times they're in relationships with men where they're more competent. See? And so this is why I said the strong Black woman facilitates the weak Black male. See, this is the reason why they masculinized the sisters. It's the reason why they gave them this faux strength, knowing that that template for operating would not be conducive to the larger American society and context, because the context is a male dominated context. So it's a male paradigm. And so because it's a male paradigm, only the males can oppose it. As my great brother Cerulean Gray always says, our mandate is to oppose the environment, the sexual dimorphic principles. What's up, Phantom? The sexual dimorphic principles which put the anatomical, biological, and neurological and psychological differences between men and women is not so that the man can lord over the woman. It's so he can oppose the environment. Conversely, the fact that as the woman you have the life-giving, life-incubating source of your vagina and of your womb and of maternity is not given to you so you can use that and lord over the men with it. That's not what it's for. Trying to use our respective attributes that come with our gender and our biology to subjugate one another and then wonder why we can't get along. Because you've internalized whiteness. That's why. That's why you can't get along. See? So, what, you wanted to say something?
Oh, no, I was just clearing my throat. I wanted to piggyback off of some of the points that you just made.
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Well, to piggyback off of you giving the example about the female who called you and was sharing with you her, you know, right, dating situation or whatnot. I live in Indiana.
Right.
And it's the population is like, I live in Fort Wayne, Indiana. The population is like 265,000, and most of the men that I meet here, mm-hmm. not only just myself,
right,
many other women who I encounter and socialize with, most men here, and the cost of living here is low. Right. However, most of the men don't really make that much money,
mm-hmm.
And when they do make money, they do not want to be with one person.
Yep.
They like to move around, as I call it.
Mm-hmm.
And also for me, like, since I make good money, sometimes I don't, with me being back in the dating field, I've been divorced for 6 years and I just started back dating. But
right.
Most men who I meet, I don't even tell them up front that I own a company, because then they start acting weird or, you know, making certain types of comments.
Or they're feeling intimidated.
Mm-hmm. Right. I'm sorry, Vance, go ahead.
Well, you know what? I like to try to dissect that intimidation thing, because when you look at intimidation, it basically means to be in fear of. So it's a lot of double talking going on. So it's like in one breath, you want us to be strong and independent and not need you. And then when you meet somebody like me who has a house, three cars, a business, a couple of businesses, but right. You meet me, then you end up, the things that you say that you like about me essentially later on become a problem for you, though, not me. But it becomes a problem. And I meet men all the time that try to compete with me about money or what I do. And it's like, why does that have to be a competition? Because, like I said, I feel like I was forced to be, I'm everybody's go-to person. And my family, I'm everybody's go-to person when they need a ride or money. But then at the same time, I'm always being talked about as, oh, well, she thinks she's white. She thinks she's better than us. I get that from my immediate family all the time. They think that I don't know that they have these opinions about me, but I know that they do. And they say it. And it's like, it doesn't bother me anymore, but it used to, because what bothered me was that they equated someone wanting to be successful and not wanting to have the stereotypical black lifestyle, just not doing anything or just having a regular job, or, I don't drink and I don't smoke. So I get attacked for that. Oh, you think you're better because you don't drink or smoke.
Right.
How do I think I'm better because I don't drink or smoke? It's just like it's a choice for you to drink and smoke. It's a choice for me to not be a drinker and not be a smoker. So how does that equate to me thinking I'm better when those words never come out of my mouth? I don't walk around saying that. But that just lets me know that you think that I'm better than you, though, because you have, basically a poverty mindset and you don't see yourself stepping outside of the box and doing anything different. So try to project that onto me like I'm a problem, when really that's a you problem, not a me problem. And I'm just not going to worry about that. And, you just need to deal with that inside yourself. But back to the male thing, I meet men all the time. They don't make much money, or because of my past situations, I choose to not date someone who doesn't make as much money as me or more money than me too. So that it's easier for me to weed out who really actually likes me, or if they're just trying to use me because I am resourceful and I do know how to make things happen. And that tend to happen to me a lot. It's happened a lot. And my ex-husband used to say certain things, like when he would leave and disappear and be with other women, and then he'd come back and say, hey, you know, we need to get back together. I need a wife and a secretary. You know, these other women, they don't know how to make things happen like you do.
Right.
And I would be like,
hey, interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. But I want to address something, because I see some individuals in the chat room talking about nature, that there is no equality in nature. But there's also no rule of law in nature. You see what I'm saying? This is what happens when we try and use a template. It's the reason why we call the wild wild. So that's not an adequate example for this idea of supposed inherent male dominance. See, that's not an adequate example of that. Just to build on that a little bit more. If you point to a species where the male is in the dominant position, okay, fine. But then you would also have to do the same thing. You would have to make the same observation where the female of that species is in the dominant position, like hyenas, for example. See, so what you see is a representation of both. You still see a representation of both. See, what the problem is that we don't understand equality. We don't understand it. We think we understand it, but we don't. What you have, hey, Remy, what you have is a division in the species where all the power isn't vested in one aspect. separation, the church, checks and balances, divided government. Brothers who want to push these tropes about patriarchy, I'll pose you a question. Give me one patriarchy that is 100% male. Sisters who want to talk about this matriarchy as if they're supposed to be in a preeminent position over men, give me one matriarchy that exists entirely of women. It's impossible. It's impossible. That's the point. The hierarchies that we understand are, number one, social constructs, and number two, they're familial. That's what I was just breaking down. We have to understand that. We think we understand equality. We don't. Because men can do more than women. But that's not to say that women should be relegated as a lower social class. That is absurd to assert that. And then when white men use these same ideas when it came to black men, you have a problem with it. But then you want to turn right around and use those same ideas to do it to your own woman. And then wonder why you're in the condition you're in when it comes to your woman. When it's obvious that that's not an adequate social order, because look at feminism. That's not going to work. That is not going to work. We have to change our viewpoints on how we look at these words and these terms. There is no balance, cannot exist in an unequal environment. See, so just because you can do more than the woman physically doesn't mean you're supposed to lord over the woman. That's not what that's for. Because even though you can lord over the woman, even though you can do more than the woman physically, you can't birth children. So you need her equally as much as she needs you. Unless you're suggesting that you're going to use the fact that you're bigger and stronger than her to rape her. And we know this is what patriarchal societies have done.
It's rape culture.
Exactly. But we want to act like what the feminists be saying is just made up. Fuck out of here, man. No, I'm not going for that. But anyway, let me get back to this Sapphire caricature for a little while. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to share the link, but I'm not real tech savvy, so I don't know how to copy.
No, just keep talking, Mary. Is this a street tonight? I mean today.
Okay.
So anybody else that they'll ask in the chat room then, you know.
All right. I'm gonna read a little bit more, and then I gotta give this other guy the email. And we can deal with this ADOS problem he has. But it says it was not. Huh?
Oh, Cerulean?
Yeah, you can give it to Cerulean.
No. Keep talking. Go ahead.
Okay. It was not until the Amos and Andy radio show that the characterization of African-American women as domineering, aggressive, and emasculating shrews, became popularly associated with the name Sapphire. The show was conceived by Freeman Godson and Charles Correll, two white actors who portrayed the characters Amos Jones and Andy Brown. By mimicking and mocking black behavior and dialect. At its best, Amos and Andy was a situational comedy. At its worst, it was an auditory minstrel show. The show, with a mostly white cast, aired on the radio from 1928 to 1960. With intermittent interruptions, the television version of the show, with network television's first all-black cast, aired on CBS from 1951 to 1953, with syndicated reruns from 54 to 66. It was removed in large part through the efforts of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People and the Civil Rights Movement. That's another achievement of the Civil Rights Movement. Both as a radio show and television show, Amos and Andy was extremely popular, and this was unfortunate for African Americans because it popularized racial caricatures of blacks. American learns that blacks were comical, not as actors, but as a race. See that? So what they essentially do is they essentially outsource the inferiorization of black people psychologically to black people, where we put these things out about ourselves. And so I just wanted to deal with that. When sisters have, you know, things to say to brothers, be more cognizant of how you're communicating, because these stereotypes are still prevalent in society today. And unfortunately, a lot of times we engage in behaviors that reinforce these stereotypes, both as Black men and Black women. Let me try and get this brother email. Von Shea and Cass, what's y'all in the closing thoughts on that? I got to send this email.
My closing thoughts is, actually, I don't have them right now. You go ahead. now that I think about it.
What about you, Von Shea?
Yeah, no, I don't really have any closing thoughts neither. You always bring up some good points that make me think, and I'm sure everyone else who listens to you think as well. So I don't really have any.
Appreciate that.
Anything.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm dealing with this brother who has a problem. He has a problem with the video I did on the ADOS movement.
I didn't get to see that. What were you talking about in there?
I'm just talking about the fact that that as ADOS Americans, we have a right to distinguish ourselves. We have a right to make a claim about reparations and being compensated for our heritage and for our lineage, because we exist in a continuum, a racial, social, economic, and political continuum. Like for me, like we like to talk as if these things are somehow relics of the past. Well, my pops was born in 1940.
If Roddy was a straight baby boomer, I'm saying before they even started labeling it, back 5 years after the 40s.
Right. And so he was born in an impoverished sharecropper South. So the fact that he died without anything to pass on is relevant because of how white society maldistributed resources. You see what I'm saying? They maldistributed resources. So this is why he didn't have anything to pass on. See what white society likes to do is they like to portray this as if this is due to just Black incompetence. You see what I'm saying? When what they've done, they've used their unilateral control over, what's up, blessed one, over the systems and apparatuses of American society to, in effect, engage in welfare fraud. But then they want to turn around and vilify Black people for not having what they have. You know, we all heard this speech about Martin Luther King, while telling a Negro to pull himself up by his own bootstrap. They flooded America with European peasants and then undergirded those peasants with an economic floor, an economic base. Mm-hmm. Land grant colleges, the GI Bill, all these different things. What's up, Art Nouveau? All these different things. So see, the white American middle class is
fading.
It's not that it's fading. It's a government creation. It's a shining indictment of the success of welfare. White supremacy is welfare because you get unearned benefits. That's the entitlement. See? So now, like Martin Luther King said, we coming for the check. We want our check. And we're not disparaging other ethnic groups who may be identified as Black but don't have the American descendant of slaves lineage. What we're saying is stay out of our way. You know, that's what we're saying.
But they're not going to stay out of the way. Because
but that's the problem.
You know why? Mm-hmm. Because like my good friend that's downstairs said it, they're getting it because of what we call the what's that thing again? Foreign aid.
Exactly.
America. And America gives out, if we calculate all the foreign aid, I wouldn't be surprised it reached a trillion or more.
Right.
Just yeah, that alone.
Foreign aid is they give trillions of dollars, and that's our money. We pay taxes. As Americans, we pay taxes, man. You see what I mean? And then these individuals come from these other places and have the nerve to look down on us when your entire ride has been subsidized and financed by our money, by our tax dollars. What's up, Remy? Remy, you want the link?
That sounds like the Burmese population here in my.
Okay, here go my brother Monday. And what's up, brother?
What's happening, man? I say today I really want to know what's happening. I really want to know, mm-hmm. you know, why is the so-called anti-black mm-hmm. non-AWS problem going on in the United States? So I know you are more educated that you know because sometimes it's a lot of ignorant AWS. So I just be blocking right. the air. But you, I know you're more educated. We can definitely talk from an educative perspective.
Right. My thing is this. I have no problem with my brothers who come from other places. That's not what the ADOS movement is about. What the ADOS movement is about is it's unfair to act like because they allow immigrants who are black from other places – it's unfair for us to act and pretend as if that's some form of compensation or reparations for our specific. There's an echo.
That's not me.
Which I understand that you know, because from me speaking, I'm speaking from a global perspective because I've been to almost four continents on this planet. You know,
right.
When it comes down to ADOS, I don't have. I was stated for the record. I have no problem because when it comes down to all those genocides and Holocaust that have been perpetrated amongst other people, Jewish, all those German and all this crazy stuff that happened in the past, they were all paid for it. You know, so I have no problem with ADOS getting that reparation because at the end of the day,
right.
slavery was barbaric. You know, it was inhuman. Yeah. I condemn that 100%. You know? So I have right, no right. problem with ADOS seeking for reparation because that is what is supposed to, that's what's supposed to happen, you right, know. Right. But the only time I have a problem is when ADOS have a problem with we that came, because me speaking from my own perspective from Nigeria, we love mm-hmm. Americans with passion. Mm-hmm. Like
right.
if you have a chance and you visit Nigeria, you wouldn't even want to come back to the United States. Because of how people, because we know the history, we don't even have to go to school to learn it. We go to every slave dungeon as a vacation. What is it called? Where you take kids in school yeah, sure. and go show them, you know, like a tall picnic or something like that. So we all know the history of what happened to the black people in Jamaica, Haiti, whatever. As long as they brought you over here, we know the history. So once we see anybody, be you Jamaican, Haitian, or whatever you're from. We gravitate towards you like a brother, you know. So right. I came over here with that mentality, thinking, that's how things go. So when I came here, I was resented. So I have to put up a shield and become aggressive too, because that's the society that we're living in, you know. And most people in Africa up to this day don't even understand. You know, not until right. they come over here and they come and they you know get a little bit grip of that feeling, then they're gonna put up a resentment too, because there is no way you're gonna love people who don't love you. It doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. You know, you can only hold on for so long. But once you understand that this is how these folks think, you know, you're gonna get to a point where you're gonna say, in fact, fuck you. You know, so I don't have no problem with ADOS, not at all, because you guys deserve it. But,
right,
you know, right. I keep going online and seeing all this Tariq and all this ADO. All the main focus is anti-blacks who are not ADOS. And that is really, really out of proportion. That's how I look at it. Because if I have a problem with anybody, I'm going to face my problem. I don't have to look for, the white people are too powerful. Let's look for the weaker people. You know, because that's how it seemed to me.
That's how I feel. Well, let me address Tariq right fast. I'm a mute you because you have an echo. But let me address Tariq. I think I like Tariq Nasheed. I think he's intelligent. I don't think he's a historian, though. He has a lot to offer. But I also think that I think he's sincere to an extent. But I think that he's latched on to this ADOS movement, because I've noticed the shift in his rhetoric, too. If you go back and you look at his rhetoric from a few years ago, he was more on a Pan-Africanist tip. Now he's I think he is going a bit overboard with demonizing, black people from other places. I'm not anti-immigrant, but it becomes a problem when the Democrats and their shills use immigration as a means to undermine ADOS progress. And that's what the point I was making earlier. We can't act as if because black people from other places, immigrants come here and do well, as if that's progress for ADOS Americans. See, because the economic pie of American society isn't infinite. It's a finite pie. It's a finite economic pie. And so when you come here, let's not act like you're not taking food out of our mouths. And mm-hmm. then what the dominant society will do is be like, well, look at those black people. They're doing this, this, and this, and this, and this. And then, but why can't you ADOS niggas do it? Well, the reason why you ADOS Negroes can't do it is because you're lazy, you're criminal, you're having all these kids out of wedlock, you're running around here with all these STD seals. So what they've done, they've weaponized your immigrating over here. But personally, I have no problems with my African brothers and sisters. My best friend is from Trinidad. You know, he's a Trinidadian. He came here from Trinidad early 2000. That's my best friend. So I have no problem with with our brothers and sisters from other places. What we're talking about now is we're talking about a political movement. And so what happens, many non-ADOS brothers and sisters have this sense of entitlement with it, where they can stick their nose into our political business. That's the problem. That's what we have a problem with. Just stay in the background and let us handle what we're trying to handle, because as you said, we deserve it, and we have a case for getting our reparations. America has paid reparations to every other group except black people. And so that's what the ADOS movement is about. And one thing I am working on is I'm trying to get Yvette Carnell on my podcast, because she, her and Antonio Moore were the founders of it. And so I want to get her on just to get more insight about it. But it's not an anti-black immigrant movement. One thing we got to understand, too, is that immigration isn't just for black people. You have immigrants coming from Europe. You have immigrants coming from South America. You have European immigrants, Mexican immigrants, et cetera, et cetera. And so what they're doing is, in the American political order, they're using these things to further push ADOS blacks to the margins. That's the problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, can you hear me now?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay,
you gotta turn up your YouTube, because that's what's bringing the feedback.
Say that again.
Yeah, if you have any other device on, like a YouTube running, turn it off right now. Turn feedback. I can hear you.
Yeah, you have an echo Monday.
Oh. I don't really know. Probably because I'm speaking direct from I just clicked the link and I was just talking and I was online too.
Let me see if the echo's there. No, the echo's still there. Yeah, it's
gonna still there.
You might jump out and jump back in. The computer gonna hear a feedback. It's gonna be hard to hear you.
Jump out Monday and then come back in. Vance, what's your thoughts on the ADOS movement?
My thoughts on that is, I do agree with mostly everything that you were saying and the points that you were making. But I just feel like most people only want to have an opinion or support the movement if they feel like they can get something out of it or benefit from it. Other than that, I feel like most people, they don't care.
Right.
And that's basically it in a nutshell. You know, I feel like a lot of people are opportunists and look for different situations, and or whether it's a group of people or organization, I feel like they look for certain situations to help them benefit for whatever it is they feel that their rights are, or whatever it is they feel like they.
All right, Monday, you still got it, man. You're killing us with that.
Are you using a phone or computer?
What you say, Monday?
I'm using a phone.
Yeah, that might be.
I don't know why you have an echo.
Yeah, because
we got your point, Monday. What our can do. They can play a supplementary role in us getting what we deserve. That's all it's about. It becomes more problematic when they interject themselves into our political affairs with our government. And see, our situation as ADOS Americans is unique because we're the only group of people who are being oppressed by their home government based along racial lines. Something I was mentioning earlier, I talked about the high levels of hypersegregation that we still suffer from, and that hypersegregation plays a large part into how many of the problems we talk about play themselves out, whether we're talking about unemployment, intimate partner violence, STDs, abortions. It's not a mistake that they put abortions in predominantly black areas. I mean, abortion clinics like Planned Parenthood in predominantly black areas. So we get your point. I'm about to get off of here because I've been on here longer than what I wanted. I hope that I brought a level of insight when dealing with the dilemmas of black manhood and black womanhood. This is going to be like a series I'm going to do. I'll hop back and forth between a dilemma that black men face and then a dilemma that black women face. So today we focused on the sapphire caricature of the angry black woman that black women are faced with, that stereotype, that stigma. Next Sunday, I'll deal with the brute caricature, the way that black men are portrayed, and how this goes a long way into rendering black men as invisible when it comes to being victims. Are we victims? Can we be victims? Are we perceived as victims? And how this has an effect and a counter effect in our communities with our sisters, between black men and black women. So that's what I'm going to be doing next Sunday. I appreciate everybody for tuning in. Hit like, share, subscribe, share the content. We're on a mission to bring a better class of revolutionary, a better mode of revolutionary thought, operating in nuance, not being overly ideological, emotional, but being logical, reasoned, patient, and dissecting these issues down from a place of objectivity and not personalizing any issue to bring light to those who want to see the light. So with that, I'm going to end the stream. Again, we'll be on later on this evening at 7:30 on our blog talk show. It's going to be me, my brother Chaos Rain, and my two new co-hosts, Von Shay and Nikki, the sister cousins. Wait, what you said it was? Von Shay, sister cousins from around the way or something? I can't remember.
Yeah, we, because my cousin, she's my cousin, but she's more like my sister.
Right.
And we will be everyone else's sister cousins, and we will be giving y'all that game.
Okay. Yes, ma'am. That's what it's about. Y'all know what it is. Make Black America great again or die trying. Peace.
Mm-hmm.